Former Kansas City Police Department intelligence detective and now attorney Gary Jenkins produced four documentary films, most recently Gangland Wire, true stories of the mob skimming from the Las Vegas casinos in the 1970s. Creator of smartphone app entitled Kansas City Mob Tours. Download it now. If you like what you hear, go to ganglandwire.com. Navigate to the shop page. We need you to put a hit out on our donate button. Buy the DVD Gangland Wire or download the Kansas City Mob Tour app. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/ganglandwire. Follow true crime storyteller Gary Jenkins on Twitter at Jenks Law. And now, here's Gary Jenkins.
Now, welcome, folks. This is Gary Jenkins, your friendly host at Gangland Wire Crime Stories. I'm here in the deep, dark confines of the Big Dumb Fun Show studio with my friend and co-host, Aaron. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
You know, you can tune in to hear Aaron and his show, the Big Dumb Fun Show, live every Monday night. And you can also go to www.bigdumbfunshow.com, and he's got previous shows archived there. He'll have local comedians and independent musicians come in and play and talk about their music and play music from independent musicians from all over the United States. It's a pretty interesting show.
You know, it's 11 years now.
It's been 11 years.
This is really coming up. By the time this comes out, it'll be like the 18th of August, be 11 years.
Interesting.
Now everybody's doing this stuff. But
I've known you that long. I didn't know. I didn't realize you'd been doing this that long.
You know, I have. And sometimes it gets hard to find a new good guest.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Playing so many people, but they go on. Yeah. And I get to do stuff. The best part about the program, about the Big Dumb Fun Show, sometimes is having these facilities.
Yeah.
So that I can do other things. Like,
yes, like this.
Like true crime stories with Gary Jenkins.
Cool.
And we have another little side project we're doing, and we've been doing here. We've got like three episodes called Sarcasm Cinema, where we basically make fun of feature films.
Oh, wow.
And you play the recording of us making fun of the film while you're watching the movie. So we've already recorded one and released it. It's for Invasion of the Body Snatchers. It's up there on BigDumbFunShow.com. You can check that out. Watch Invasion of the Body Snatchers DVD or get it online, and you start it when we say start the movie now, and we make fun of a movie. And then we've done Jaws, which is yet to be released, and
that'd
Sandlot.
Sandlot, oh yeah. That was
a great
fun
summer movie.
Yes, it is. Interesting. I'll have to try that. I didn't really realize you were doing that.
Yeah, that's just kind of a new thing we just launched here. But more importantly,
onto the
Gangland Wire
crime stories. You know, and I want to just mention to people out there, we've gotten quite a few downloads and we're building all the time. And if you have any feedback or suggestions for topics, or you just want to say hello or make a connection with me, why, make a comment on my blog page at www.ganglandwire.com, or email me at jinxlaw@yahoo.com, or my Twitter handle is @jinxlaw. That's @JENKSLAW. I'm becoming quite the Twitterer here lately, and I'm starting to figure out how you do hashtags and communicate with people via Twitter.
You need to get an Instagram account.
Yeah, I do.
I tagged you on a photo of Union Station,
right,
from the, I was down there this afternoon taking a photo and listening to the
Union Station Massacre.
The Union Station Massacre, which is a three-episode podcast that people should download and listen to. And here's a question for you. What if you were, say, an officer of the law and you had a true crime story? Could somebody email you?
Yeah, email me. Come in and be my guest. Come in and tell your story on the Gangland Wire crime stories. I'm kind of a mob expert because of my history, but I'm doing other things. I've done some crime stories about before I became a mob expert. When I was a young policeman, I did one about the Ku Klux Klan investigation we did of them, and I'll do most any true crime story. So if you've got one, or if
you're a mob member and say you want to come
member,
in and talk, it's just audio. No one's going to know who you actually are.
Right. And Aaron, do you have one of those things that disguises voices?
No, I don't. It's in front of your microphone.
Oh yeah, the spit catcher.
We could do that, I'm sure.
Yeah, we could. And you know, I want to mention and thank some people here. You know, we have asked for donations, and we're going to continue to ask for a little donation because we got to pay for studio time, and I've made some Freedom of Information Act requests and some other minor expenses, I guess. But
you're hosting the podcast so people can download it.
And I'm hosting the podcast. I got to pay for that hosting service. And so I got a variety of expenses, and we don't charge anybody for it. So I wouldn't mind getting a donation. I made a donation button. You can make a donation through PayPal on my shop page at www.ganglandwire.com. And I'd like to thank Barry Parks. Mr. Parks, I really appreciate what you did. Michael Ledlow and Myra Watson for their assistance in keeping this going and helping us cover our expenses.
Making a donation.
And by making a donation, it was great. You know, I also want to mention my friend and fellow mob historian, Terrence O'Malley, who was here last month, and we did the 3-episode series on the Union Station massacre. Terrence O'Malley, thank you very much. He is an expert on that 30s mafia and political Pendergast history and the Union Station massacre. He did a movie just about the Union Station massacre as a work for hire for the Union Station.
And you can find him online
he has got 3 websites. One is Nellie Don, A Stitch in Time. Just Google that. Or blackhandstrawman.com or tomandharrydocumentary.com. That's a documentary he did, his most recent one, which is about Tom Pendergast and Harry Truman and their relationship. And he found some really cool, rare 16mm home movies of a Pendergast wedding that he was able to put in that movie. I don't know how he never did tell me how he found that.
He
got
just
that.
Showed up.
He had a connection somehow. It was cool. You know, and one last thing, and we'll get on with this. We've been messing around long enough. I just want to mention our favorite nonprofit around here, First Call. Make First Call your first call when you have a relative, employee, or friend with addiction problems. Call 816-361-5900 or go to www.firstcallkc.com. And they have a Facebook page, too. You can find them on Facebook. And I'm going to discuss how the Midwest mob families obtained so much influence over the Central States Teamsters Pension Fund. Now, you know, this pension fund, I'm not sure it was probably over $1 billion back then. It was certainly several hundred million because I'm a member of the board of the Kansas City Police Pension Fund. We have $800 million that we invest. And if on our board, if 5 of us were to agree to make a multi-million-dollar loan to an individual to buy a casino, we could do that. And in return, I'm sure we could easily obtain some large kickbacks if we chose the right individual to loan the money to. And it almost seems too easy. I watch us invest $20 million here and $50 million there with these big companies, and we have really rigid rules about we can't take anything more from a vendor or a client company than a meal.
But you can get a dividend from the investment.
Well, the pension board gets the dividend.
There's like interest if it's a loan or a bond, and
yeah, but
and
I mean,
the
that,
pension
that's
fund
why we,
grows that way.
Yeah, yeah, that's how we loan them. We give them money to invest in other companies.
Mm-hmm.
Now, what the Teamsters Pension Fund was doing, they were giving people who wanted to buy casinos in Las Vegas money. And the people that would facilitate the loan got a kickback from that. So that's what we're going to talk about. And I'm going to tell you a little bit. You know, if you think about it, La Cosa Nostra Mafia, a Sicilian-based mafia, came out of the Black Hand Movement. The early immigrants came to the United States from Sicily. And they first preyed on their own people. Extorted money from other shopkeepers. I think Nick Sabella's father had money extorted from him from the Black Hand in Kansas City. And then Prohibition hit, and they had this huge source of income. The profits were just unbelievable. In 1925, Time Magazine printed, a case at Rum Row was $25. That's out in the what they called Rum Row was the ships that were smuggling rum in from, say, Cuba. Once it got on the beach, a case went to $40, and to the retail bootlegger, it's $50, and to the consumer, it was $70 a case, or about $6 a bottle. Now, that doesn't seem like very much now, because $6 for a bottle of rum, but back then, that was probably like about $50 or $60 for a bottle of rum.
Back in the 30s.
Back in the 30s and the 20s. And there was thousands of jobs during that time created to secretly make and transport homemade liquor and to smuggle factory-made booze in from Canada and Mexico. And when the Prohibition was over, this all dried up. You know, to kind of put this in perspective, I looked this up on the Internet, probably Wikipedia, I can't remember, but $1,000 in 1925 would be about like $12,000 today. So, but by the time Prohibition ended, every major city from Kansas City east to New York City had a politically connected, powerful criminal organization called the Syndicate, the Mob, the Mafia, La Cosa Nostra, the Outfit, the Clique, or this thing of ours is one thing I've heard this called. So every one of them had it, and during this time, the Teamsters Union was one of the most powerful and most corrupt unions in the United States. They had a long-time president named Daniel Tobin that was pretty corrupt, and in 1953 he handpicked his successor, a man named Dave Beck, and I think Beck ended up going to jail, but he was notoriously corrupt, and he took some steps to make sure he was Teamsters president for life. But Jimmy Hoffa was an up-and-comer in 1956. Jimmy Hoffa kind of made the first known connection with the mafia, a gangster named Johnny Dio, and they rigged the next Teamsters president election, and Hoffa ended up becoming the Teamsters president. And, you know, in Kansas City at that time, we had an up-and-comer in Local 41 of the Teamsters Union. There was a man named Roy Lee Williams. Now, a little bit about Roy Lee Williams. He got kind of an interesting background. He started driving trucks down in Wichita for a small trucking company in 1935, and in 1941, as with most able-bodied men in the United States, he went to World War II. He went to war. And he came back, 1945, Roy Williams came back a war hero as a Silver Star winner. Now, the first known contact between Hoffa and Williams was around 1950, when Jimmy Hoffa appointed Roy Lee Williams as trustee to a local in Wichita, Kansas. And by 1952, Williams was appointed to the joint council that supervised all locals in the western Missouri, all the Teamster locals in western Missouri and Kansas, and soon he became the president of Local 41 in Kansas City, Missouri, which is the most powerful Teamsters union in the Midwest, outside of Chicago and Cleveland and Milwaukee.
What's the role of a trustee?
A trustee would be, there would be several trustees who would...
Operate it as an entity?
As an entity, a board of trustees, and operate as an entity, and they would oversee union, and they would
collection
be the ones...
Collection of dues.
And sit on negotiating committees with trucking companies, and they were in a good position. When you're in a good position like that, you can get kickbacks. If, say, a trucker... a small company has a bunch of truckers that have a grievance about some unsafe work conditions. Mm-hmm. And so they go to their union. Their union goes to the trucking company and this board of trustees, if you've got some corrupt people on it, then they can go to the board of directors or the president, say, of a small trucking company or a big trucking company, too. Even probably all the way up to like Yellow Freight, you know, they had to deal with the Teamsters.
Well, but at the same time, wouldn't they could maybe get a kickback, they still need to protect their members if there was legitimate complaint?
Kind of, but if they complain too much, what the mob guys are around for, if they complain too much. I saw that. I worked in the UAW up at Clay Como in 1968-69, and I saw this one night. There was out in back of the Union Hall, there was a impromptu crap game going, and everybody was drinking. And my job was, I was a young guy before I became a policeman, and my job was to stand there and hold a flashlight. So there was two, they're UAW, United Automotive Workers, but there's two what we call committee men, and those are the people that represented the line workers, the employees. Mm-hmm. And there's a brand new foreman there, and they were shooting dice, and they were shooting dice for a lot of money. His name was Ray Reitinger. He's dead now, Cowboy Ray Reitinger. He would get the dice, and he'd drop them, and then he'd pick them back up, and then he'd make about 10 straight passes, and this foreman was just losing, you know, money out the butt.
Mm-hmm.
And then he'd drop them, and he'd right outside the light, and I tried to shine the light over there. He said, no, leave that on. And then he'd pick them up. What he was doing was changing dice.
Changing the dice
he'd
out.
He put the dice back, you know, put the good dice back in, and then the foreman, he'd start, you know, he maybe he'd make a pass, win a bet, but then he'd lose pretty quick, and then they'd get the next union guy, he'd get them, he'd drop them, and he'd reach out and get them and come back, and he'd make about 10 passes.
And nobody ever catch on to this?
You know, I did. Because I told that foreman, he was
a nice guy.
That's
where the kickback comes in.
Sure, he was a nice guy, and I told him later, I didn't get the kickback. See, I didn't get that. I thought they were just cheating him.
Well, they were.
It wasn't until years later that I got, it was a kick, he was paying them off that way.
Oh.
Yeah, because I told him, I said, you know, I said, they were cheating you, Bill. His name was Bill something. He said they were. I said they were cheating you. He just said, ah, "Don't worry about it." And I thought that's funny. So I didn't. I went on, and I was young and dumb and didn't know what I was doing. And years later, when I became a policeman and was working in organized crime and working with these kinds of things, I thought they were. He was just paying them off because he was a new foreman and he didn't want any trouble with the union. So he could lose
throw
a bunch
some
of
dice
money.
And
he could lose $500 to them, which was a lot of money in 1968. And his union trouble just got cut way back. So that's how it works. But
Roy Lee Williams, he moves up from being a trustee to actually being the president of
the local 41. And so he has huge power to make contracts with Yellow Freight and Consolidated Freightways and all the big freight company, local freight companies. It was pretty well known in the 70s that Yellow Freight was a place that had to hire some of these mob guys, and they kind of had to come to work or they didn't. There were some no-show jobs, I think, and when they were there, they didn't really have to do very much.
It was just a cover.
It was just a cover, yeah. They wanted to keep union trouble down, and that was a way to do it. We had several mob guys working there. As Hoffa and Roy Lee Williams rose up in the ranks of the Teamsters, and they had this unholy alliance with the mob. If they had a problem with another union member, the mob would take care of it. If they had a problem with a company, say they had a company that they wanted a little more out of in the contract, and the company wasn't going to give it, and they were out on strike, and they wanted to get it settled in their favor, why, you just go to your mob buddies and say, hey, cause this company a little trouble. And you know, they've got the criminals working for them, and so they can go in and maybe burn out a warehouse or slash a bunch of tires or do some kind of
criminal, give them a message.
Send a message, yeah. And so it was, it was a match made in hell for the United States, the people of the United States, and for
what
the
about
union
just the regular members,
the companies, and the regular members
just wanted to have a job.
Right, right. They just wanted to have a job. They didn't want to know about any of this stuff. So, I want you to listen to Aaron. Pull up that Owsley Teamster One. This is an interview with retired FBI agent Bill Owsley, where he relates the first known contact between Nick Civella and Roy Lee Williams.
He first became really acquainted with Nick at a ad hoc political committee that he sat on, with Nick representing, of all things, the political entity of the North End. The mayor of Independence, Sermon, was a member, Williams was a member, and some others. And the idea behind it was that this ad hoc committee would review all of the candidates, select one that they thought was the best, and try to get all of the divergent political factions together rather than fighting each other. And this committee was the one that picked that person and recommended him. So here's Nick sitting next to Roy Williams on the committee, just like the fox sitting next to the chicken, who he's eventually going to eat him. So the relationship began.
So that's the first known relationship of Nick Civella and Roy Lee Williams. You know, and think about it. Politics was a lot more straightforward, corrupt in those days. And you got the boss of the Kansas City Mafia sitting on a Democratic Party committee in Jackson County that was going to choose candidates to run for office, and who would they back and who would they not back? They didn't use lobbyists back in those days and have them go around and slip you a case of wine or
even though he was a known mob associate?
This was 1950s Kansas City, Jackson County. We still were not out of the Pendergast era yet. Pendergast was gone, and there was a lot of different, a lot cleaner politics than it had been. So you can imagine what it was like back in the 30s if it was still like this on up into the 50s and even up into the 60s, really.
More like the Teamsters Union.
Yes, yes. And so, I mean, I always say you, if you didn't have a little corruption, it wouldn't be a big city. It kind of makes our lives more interesting. Gives us
and
some
if you
headlines.
Had a lot of corruption?
And we've had a lot of corruption. It gives you better headlines. Before we go on, let's just take a little short break here.
And now for a word from our sponsors and about the program itself and the opportunities that you can have to download other episodes for free and donate to Gangland Wire, Crime Stories, to keep this program going.
Thanks, Aaron. You know, one of the first known examples of mob intervention union activities that made the headlines, I'll say that's why it's known, it came from a pretty unlikely place, the Kansas City, Missouri Fire Department. Now, if you ever wonder, the police department has always resisted unionization and resisted any connection with the fire department and the fire department union during my tenure. Now, they're a lot closer now, and now we have the Fraternal Order of Police, which is basically a police union and does a bargaining event with the city to get a contract just like any normal union would. But back then, we didn't. And Bill Owsley in his book, Mobsters in Our Midst, which, by the way, is a great book, Mobsters in Our Midst. You can get that on Amazon.com. He doesn't sell it anyplace else. But anyhow, he reports that the Teamsters started a drive to take control of Firefighters Local 42 in Kansas City. And the Firefighters president was a battalion captain named Stanton Gladden. And I remember this as a kid. And he resisted those Teamsters' efforts. They wanted to keep the fire union as part of the National Fire Union, and they did not want the Teamsters moving in. And the city was pretty corrupt at the time, and they were not going to really resist a Teamsters take over the fire department because they could probably deal with the Teamsters under the table a lot easier than they could the Firefighters Union. Now, we had a politically appointed fire chief named Edgar Grass, and he had offered a promotion to this battalion chief, Glanton, in order to support the Teamsters Union among the rank and file, and Gladden, he threatened to expose this offer, and Nick Civella's brother, Cork, we've talked about Carl Cork Civella, he was kind of the consigliere to the boss, Nick Civella. Anyhow, Cork is a fiery guy, too, and he's a very dangerous guy. He's much more impulsive and much more likely to hurt you than Nick Civella is. Nick Civella might get you hurt, but Cork Civella will do it impulsively. Nick Civella would only do it as a calculated risk.
That's why they call him Cork, because his
pop off, yeah. And he asked this Stanton Gladden, Captain Gladden, to meet and discuss this issue, whether he's going to expose this offer of a promotion from the fire chief to support the Teamsters Union, and he basically said, you know, I don't care, I'm not going to do it. And Civella even offered his influence on the city council to get Gladden promoted to fire chief later on, and Gladden said, I won't do it, and he ended up reporting all this to, I think, the FBI agents at the time, as a matter of fact, and it ended up coming, he talked about it to reporters for sure.
It ended up in the Kansas City Star?
It ended up in the Star because he started his car, and a bomb exploded. And this is right out of Corky's hand playbook, right out of his playbook. I remember one time he was wanting to muscle in on a guy that had a strip club over in Kansas, the Red Apple, a guy named Bob Anderson, and he hired a guy to go put a bomb in his car, and he didn't really want the bomb to hurt the guy or kill the guy. He just wanted to scare the guy, and so this he put a bomb in the Captain Gladden's car and exploded, and it wasn't such a big bomb that it killed him, but he was injured, and he just really wanted to put pressure on him. Well, this created a huge amount of publicity, huge headlines, and Gladden talked about it to the FBI and to the reporters, and it got so far that Robert Kennedy was Attorney General at the time, and they started, this has kind of opened investigation into these activities and really kind of one of the early beginnings of the government's investigation into mob influence over the Teamsters, because the Teamsters right in the middle of this.
Did Gladden have that much influence over the firefighters?
Yeah, he was very popular. Very popular. Yeah, you got to understand, in a union, you've got a very tough, strong, charismatic, popular guy in a union. The people, guys will listen to him. That's the way it is in any, you know, kind of paramilitary.
In
any union or any paramilitary, police, fire, any those kinds of macho kind of organizations. If you got somebody that everybody respects, they'll swing a big stick. They'll have a lot of power. And people will do what they say, what they, you know. Not, he doesn't order them. He just mentions, you know, this would be a good thing, and everybody goes along with it.
Well, did Gladden... He didn't want to become a Teamster because the Teamsters were...
They were corrupt.
He already knew they were corrupt.
He knew they were. Everybody knew they were corrupt. He knew they were corrupt. Plus, he knew he'd just get shoved aside, too, more than likely. Even though they had to offer
him. Because he wasn't playing ball.
He wasn't playing ball, and eventually they'd get around to getting him. And they even offered to get him promoted to be the chief of the fire department in the end. But,
and he reported him for it.
And he reported him for it. You know, this was a man, you know. I mean, he didn't fall
for the right
games.
Thing.
He did the right thing.
And for that, they put a bomb under his car.
Exactly. And so, you know, this all kind of died out, and the mob just backed off at the time. They just totally backed off. But, you know, the mob and their influence over the Teamsters, there's an early story that... Bill tells, and it's in Mobsters in Our Midst, that what does it really mean? See, Roy Williams by this time was what we call owned by the mob. If you're involved in business in any manner with a mob, they feel like they own you and everything about you. And so, you know, I think it was in the late 60s, Nick Civella wanted the Local 41, the Teamsters Union, to participate in a medical plan. And the Teamsters would put a buck for each member into a fund. And in return, each member would have medical care with a particular doctor that Nick had already pre-chosen, who was going to get a kickback from the doctor.
As well.
As well, yes. And it's all about kickbacks and making connections. And you know, like a buck for each member, that doesn't seem like a big deal. And you get...
A buck how often?
Like out of every paycheck? I think it was out of every paycheck.
That's pretty inexpensive health insurance.
Well, they had other health insurance. This was a kind of a supplemental policy, so you could just go to this one doctor with your family and have office visits. He was corrupt as hell, too.
But it wasn't even a doctor that you picked.
they picked a doctor.
Yeah.
Yeah, and you know,
Nick Civella picked your doctor.
Yes, right. How you like that?
He knows great cancer doctors, though, I bet.
Yeah, he does. By the end, he did. But, you know, Williams kind of he kind of flinched at that, and he knew it wasn't really a good use of human union money. They already had their medical plans, and it was just an additional medical plan, and it was money out of his guys' pockets. It wasn't very much, but and he complained to Jimmy Hoffa, and Hoffa reportedly said, "Well, that's just the way it is. You got to cooperate." And Hoffa said, "You know, you just raise the union dues a little bit and cover this fee. They won't even notice it." So then Williams still is not going along, and he's visited by a Civella associate named Highway Simone, Thomas Highway Simone, who was an old-time gangster that had a place called the Pancake Patio, I think, that all the mob guys ate at and met at down about Armour and Broadway. I can't remember exactly where that is. That's one I ought to put on my app.
You should put that on your app. Any relation to Pete Simone?
He's probably an uncle, but I'm not sure. There's two branches of that Simone family. Highway, they called him Highway, and I can't remember the origin of that nickname.
Say that again. Where was his...
Highway.
Not his nickname. Oh. He had a restaurant?
He had a restaurant called the Pancake Patio.
Where was that at?
And it was on Broadway. I believe it was around Armour and Broadway.
Okay.
It might be it's not even Sydney's anymore.
Across from the F-Town Theater.
Just north of it a little bit. There's a place right on the corner that I think is like a tobacco shop now. I think it might have been there, but I'll have to look that up. Highway got hold of Roy Lee Williams and said, you know, you could get hurt if you don't go along with this plan, and if you do, well, you'll be taken care of. So he kind of claimed later in life that he didn't take the kickback, and he didn't receive anything, but he did go along with it. And you know, all during this time, and the Teamsters and other mob families in Cleveland, Milwaukee, and Chicago were doing some of these same things.
Skimming off of the Teamsters.
Skimming off the Teamsters, influencing the Teamsters, deciding who gets elected and who doesn't. And controlling
a pension fund.
And controlling the pension fund, yeah. And I've got another Owsley clip here. It's going to tell you a little bit more about when Nick Civella first asked for William's influence in granting a pension fund loan, he resisted again. So listen to this clip here from Bill Owsley about what happened when he resisted. And I think this was his last act of resistance. You'll see why.
The turning point came when the mob fully became involved with Jimmy Hoffa in raping the Central States Pension Fund, making loans to mob-supported people and what have you. Well, Nick wanted a piece of that. Roy was a key person. Roy had been appointed by Hoffa as a trustee of the pension fund, meaning he had a vote when these loan applications came up. If he had Williams in his pocket, Nick had power. He had a piece of the loan process. And with a piece of the loan process, he got a piece of what came back from it in the way of kickbacks and other monetary value. He needed Roy. And when Roy resisted, he had him picked up at the Teamster car lot, blindfolded, taken to some warehouse type of building, sat in the middle of a dark building with a spotlight in his face, and a voice out of the dark coming saying, "You will cooperate with Civella. You will follow his lead. You will do what he says. And if you don't, then you will die after your wife," and named his two daughters their ages and names. "You'll be the last to go. Do you understand this?" And Roy said he understood it fully. Went home, sought out advice as to what he could do, went to see Jimmy Hoffa. Jimmy pretty much told him, "Roy, these guys have been here way before we ever were here. They're going to be here long after we're gone." He said, "I'm tied up completely." He said, "You can run, but you can't hide." He said, "Do what they tell you."
All right, so that's what happens when you resist Nick Civella. And you know, we're kind of down to the end of our time
here. It's kind of odd that Jimmy Hoffa would be the one saying that, and he's the person who disappeared.
Yeah, right.
And they never found.
Well, you know, that's what would have happened to Roy Lee Williams if he didn't continue to go along with the program. You know, another interesting thing about that, years later, in the late 70s, when this man named Alan Glick, who got this $62 million from the Teamsters Pension Fund, bought the Stardust and the Tropicana and the Hacienda and the Marina Hotels, the one that, you know,
In Las Vegas
that the casino movie's all about, when he resisted and they had trouble with him, he did the same thing to him. He had Tuffy DeLuna approach him, and he had a piece of paper and he named off his children. And then he also had Alan Glick come to Kansas City and put him in a hotel room and then shined a bright light on him, you know, like the old time days when the police would give you the third degree and they put you in a dark room
with a light on you.
Shine a light right in your eyes so you can't see who they are. And he did that to Alan Glick years later and told him the same thing, you know.
He got picked up at the airport by Tuffy DeLuna.
Right.
He knew who these people were.
Sure, sure. Alan Glick knew who they were. Well,
he knew when he got the loan who these people were because it got taken care of through the Teamsters Union.
That's how it works, ain't it?
This is actually predating that 70s era acquisition of those casinos using Teamster funds. Here, you're talking 10 years before?
Yeah, 10 years before.
Where they're actually
back in the late
putting
60s.
Themselves in control of the pension fund.
Right. That Stardust loan, called it the Argent loan, was not the $62 million loan. That was not the first one they made. They had made other loans. And actually, I have had Teamsters tell me that, well, you know, we did pretty well off those casino loans. And you know, they did do okay off those casino loans.
Because they were actually paid off, and the interest rates were paid.
And it was just kind of the way what they were doing was they were funding organized crime and their other nefarious activities by doing that. So, you know, nothing is ever completely black and white in this life.
As clean as the Teamsters want to be, because they were only legitimately paid the above-the-table money.
Right, right. And the below-the-table money went straight to the mob.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's how it worked. And you know, let's go ahead and stop here, and we're going to take back up with talk about Chicago and Cleveland and Milwaukee and their people who they owned in the Teamsters pension fund. So I think I'll say goodnight now, Aaron. What about you?
All right. Well, remember, download.
Download the app.
Download the
Kansas
app.
Kansas City Mob Tour. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes.
Adding another location with this podcast that you can go search using the app and see, much like The Trap or Union Station.
Right.
Or Nick Savella's house.
Yes. And I'm going to talk about a house up in Nick's neighborhood in this next segment, actually.
In the old Northeast. In the next episode.
In the next episode.
Right.
And, one other thing is...
buy the DVD, ganglandwire.com.
Buy the DVD, but if you give me a $25 donation, I'll give you a Ganglandwire t-shirt. An official Ganglandwire t-shirt. So, good night, folks.
Good night.